Open your Bibles with me, please, to the book of Daniel. I am going through a series of messages that I've entitled The 12 Greatest Men of the Old Testament. We talked about the man I have listed as the 12th greatest man, Nehemiah, 2 weeks ago. Last Sunday, I brought a message on what I have listed as the 11th greatest man, that's Jeremiah. And today I want to talk about the man I believe is the 10th greatest man of the Old Testament, and that would be Daniel the prophet. Daniel chapter 1 is where we will begin. First, a couple of introductory remarks, as I do in the beginning of each one of these messages. Daniel is mentioned 83 times in 7 books of the Bible. He is the writer of the book of Daniel, of course, and he was given 5 visions or 5 prophecies. And those visions are recorded in chapters 2, 7, 8, 9, and the last one takes 3 chapters, 10 through 12. So some 3/4 of the book of Daniel is devoted to the visions and the prophecies that Daniel wrote. The rest are the historical record in the life of Daniel. Let's begin in chapter 1. In this chapter, we are introduced to him. And what we are introduced to is his knowledge, his wisdom, and his conviction. Now, understand that Daniel and his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were taken captive by the Babylonians when they were somewhere between the age of 12 and 16, depending on which Bible chronologer and historian you read. They would have been as young as 12 and no older than 16. So they were very, very young men whenever they were taken from their homes into Babylon as captives of the Babylonian Empire. In the 3rd year in the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. Notice the Lord gave the king of Judah into the hand of this pagan king. God will often use pagan nations to judge his people. And that's exactly what he's doing here in the land of Israel. He carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels unto the treasure house of his God. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well-favored and skillful in all wisdom and cunning in knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. Now among these were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names, For he gave unto Daniel the name of Belteshazzar, and unto Hananiah of Shadrach, and to Mishael of Meshach, and to Azariah of Abednego. Notice the obvious qualities that these young men possessed. These four young men in particular, and I'm sure that they were not the only ones, but these four in particular, were noted by the Babylonian rulers as being exceptional young men. They were handsome. They were intelligent. They were quick learners. They had skills in science and no doubt mathematics. They were knowledgeable, educated, smart young men. I don't know what it is about some of us who seem to disparage working hard and doing well. There is no sanctification of the spirit intrinsic to laziness. Say, well, he's just lucky. Well, it's my observation that the harder a person works, the luckier he gets. At a young age, these young men, understood the need for learning. They applied themselves to books, to science, to mathematics. They were young men that desired to apply themselves. And as they were taken into captivity, the leaders of the Babylonians took notice of their skills and of their heart and mind and the way they wanted to learn. I want to say to you young people that are in school, the only education you will regret is the one you didn't get. The only things that you will regret about learning is what you didn't learn. There is no premium on laziness and indifference and lethargy. All of the regrets that I have in this regard are the regrets of omission. The things that I should have done but didn't do. I should have studied harder. I should have taken those courses. I should have learned those lessons. I should have read those books. You will reach a point in your adult life, even though you should always be learning, no matter how old you are. There's never a time that we should not be learning and reading. I was told by a college professor many years ago, and I've remembered this. He said, you are the sum total of the books you read and the people you associate with. And that is a absolute fact. You are the sum total of what you read and who you associate with. My dad was not highly educated in the formal sense of the word. He only had, I say only, he had an eighth grade education. I would dare say, however, that an eighth grade education when my dad was in school was probably worth an AA degree in today's education. No joke. My dad was brilliant in math and science. He read constantly. He put into my heart at an early age the love of reading. And to this very day, I'm still a reader. These young men were intelligent, educated, sharp. Even at maybe 12 or 13 years of age, they stood out. Young men, young ladies, give it everything you got. Learn everything you can. Learn, read, study, apply. It's not a joke. The rest of your life is going to be the result of the kind of study that you do now. That was Daniel. That was Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But not only did Daniel have great knowledge and wisdom, but he also had great character and conviction. Look at verse 8. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. They were told to eat the diet of the Babylonians for 3 years, to be supervised by this prince of eunuchs in preparation for their appearance before the king, so that at that moment the king might appoint them to whatever task they would be assigned in the kingdom. But Daniel had a problem. The dietary laws of the Babylonians were contrary to the dietary laws that God had given to Moses. And Daniel believed in God. And he believed in the Word of God. And he had no desire to violate the Word of God. So whenever he was told to eat this food of the Babylonians, he said, I have purposed in my heart I would not defile myself with the king's meat. This is why you got to have your convictions established before the decision to use them comes up. If you don't know where you stand and why you stand there before the circumstance dictates your decision, you will probably make the wrong decision. Because all the pressure on you will be to make the wrong decision. They are captives. They're in a foreign land. They're listening to people speak a foreign language. They are in a foreign culture. And now they are being told to eat a foreign diet, to which they are not only unaccustomed, but to which they find morally offensive. You see, that message that I have in that one DVD, The Law of Necessity, so important. The law of Nebuchadnezzar said, eat this food. And Daniel said, God's law forbids me to eat that food. I must obey God rather than man. It goes back to the whole principle of Romans 13 and everything else that we've discussed. There is a law higher than the law. There is a court higher than the court. It doesn't matter what that federal judge thinks of Kim Davis. It doesn't matter what that liberal from New York who wrote us thinks about Kim Davis. Kim Davis had purposed in her heart she would not defile herself by affixing her signature to a homosexual marriage. And in doing so, she obeyed the higher law. And she was willing to go to jail for that conviction. Well, Daniel was willing to suffer for his convictions too. We're going to find out about that in a minute. But here, early on, as this young boy, I will not defy myself with the king's meat. But notice he goes about it in a very intelligent and humble manner. Not only is there no spiritual sanctification ascribed to laziness, there's no spiritual sanctification ascribed to being a jackass. Hello. A lot of people get in trouble not because of their convictions. They get in trouble because of their impolite, brutish, arrogant, proud, mouth. Daniel took a humble approach. He had already made up his mind he wasn't going to defile himself with the meat. That was already settled. But he just didn't walk up to this prince of the eunuchs and say, "Bless God, this is an ungodly law. This is, you think I'm going to do this? You're crazy. You're a monster. You're a tyrant." Like some of you do. And you wonder why nobody likes you. You can be as right as rain, but if you're a jackass, you're a jackass. And nobody likes a jackass. Thank you, sir. Thank you, ma'am. Look. The seven of us agree with that. He requested of him. He went humbly. Humility doesn't mean weakness. He presented himself politely, properly, nicely, and he requested. Again, his mind was already made up. He wasn't going to do it. But he wasn't going to be rude and crude and ugly about it. He wanted to give them a chance to be gentlemen. He wanted to give them a chance to be honorable. If you treat people honorably, many times, maybe most times, you'll be treated honorably. Now, there's some people that won't because they're just made that way. But you treat people well, and they'll treat you well for the most part. Now, God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. This heathen prince already liked Daniel. He liked the way he carried himself. He liked the way he conducted himself. He liked his manners. I love it when a young man walks up to me and sticks out his hand and gives me a firm handshake and says, "Yes, sir." You don't see that too much anymore. "Yeah. Uh-huh." "Oh, are you in school?" Yeah. You're in eighth grade? Nice to meet you. Oh no, you've never seen anything like that. I don't know where I get this from. I like to see a young man, 10, 11, 8, 12, stick out his hand, grab my hand, say, "Hello, sir, nice to meet you." Amen. I want to hug that kid, say, "Yeah, he's got a good mom and dad." Get up whenever there's a lady in the room and you got the seat and she needs one. You show manners, you young man, you stand up and you give the lady your seat. Open the door for the elderly person that's walking out in front of you. Don't just run in front of them. Basic manners are almost non-existent in our country today, which is an insult more to the parents than it is the boys and girls, of course. He was well-mannered. He had good parents. And this prince of eunuchs in Babylon loved this guy, this kid. I found him well favored. And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, "I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink. For why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your sort? Then shall ye endanger my head to the king." Look, in 3 years, I'm responsible to bring you in front of the king. And if I bring you before the king and you don't look as healthy and well-nourished and fed and so forth as your peers that are going to be eating the king's meat, I'm going to be the one. I'm going to lose my head. I'm afraid. Then Daniel said to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days. And let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Let our countenances be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat the portion of the king's meat. And as thou seest, deal with thy servants." Give us a trial of 10 days. And if we don't look as healthy or as healthier than the people that are eating the king's food, then do what you got to do. So he consented to them in this manner and proved them 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, their countenance appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. Thus Melzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine which they should drink and gave them pulse. And as for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill and learning and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding and visions and dreams. Now the end of the days that the king had said he would bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. May God help us to be found 10 times better in our heart, in our attitude, in our character, in our deportment, in our manner, than all of those who reject the God of the Bible that we serve. The onus is not on them. The onus is on us to give ourselves to that which would be in a position to become the respected leadership that God would have us to be, that we might convince the gainsaying world that God knew what he was talking about when he wrote this blessed book. Quit blaming everyone else for your failure. They found them 10 times better. They were learned, smart, educated, proper, good mind, good body, good heart, good men. In chapter 2, let's skip down to verse 46. Here we find his exaltation. Then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and worshiped Daniel and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odors unto him. This was after Daniel interpreted the dream of the king that you find earlier in this chapter. The king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of lords and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldest reveal this secret. Then the king made Daniel a great man and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. Then Daniel requested of the king that he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. His exaltation. Nebuchadnezzar was a pagan king. But through the example of Daniel and his friends, Nebuchadnezzar came to believe and trust in Daniel's God. The people that we often will reach are the people who see a God worth knowing in us. If they don't see a God worth knowing in us, they may never see a God worth knowing. Nebuchadnezzar saw Daniel's God in Daniel's face, his heart, his mind. And of course, the vision, the gift of vision that God gave to him. And Nebuchadnezzar proclaimed that Daniel's God is God of gods. Those of you that don't, you're not able to hear the letters that I read previous to the message. I want to just give you another excerpt that the audience here has already heard it. But Kathy wrote me after I was on Alex Jones this past Friday. She's telling me that she agreed with what I had to say. Kathy is an atheist, according to her. She's an atheist. She said that there's a war on Christianity going on throughout the world. And she's right. She said, her words, not mine, Christianity is what made America the great and prosperous country it is. I fear for Christians if they don't start standing up to the threat. Nebuchadnezzar was a pagan, idol-worshipping, heathen king who only knew God, Jehovah God, the true and living God, through the life of Daniel and the lives of his three companions. And through them, Nebuchadnezzar proclaimed that Daniel's God was God of gods. The onus is on us. to show the Kathys of the world that our God is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And we're not going to do that acting like a bunch of jackasses. We're going to do that acting with dignity and respect and honor, mental acumen, knowledge, gentlemanliness, womanliness, being the man and the woman that God would have us to be in an exemplary fashion. By this, others will be drawn to the God that we represent. His exaltation. I want you to notice quickly before we go on to the third point, the last verse there in verse 49. Daniel requested of the king, and they set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs. Daniel was exalted like Joseph before him. He was exalted to the number two position in the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar. Only Nebuchadnezzar was a higher authority in the land than Daniel. And as Daniel received this promotion, he didn't forget his friends. I would like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be rulers. And they were. As you climb whatever the ladder is that you're climbing of success, never forget the people that helped you get there. Which probably includes your mom and dad. Unless you have a real unfortunate home life that you had to overcome. Even if your parents weren't Christians, your parents probably contributed much to the success of your later life. It's amazing to me how some of our children, when moms and dads get old, the children of those moms and dads just forget them and do anything they can as cheaply as they can, hoping mom and dad will die as quickly as possible so they can get the money and the inheritance, caring nothing about the sacrifice that those parents gave to them when they were in diapers and could not feed themselves, and could not clothe themselves, and they needed that mom and dad to care for them and protect them, and they were willing to do so. But now when mom and dad get old, the children, hurry up, get rid of them, I want the money, I don't care about mom. I'm telling you, the love of many hath waxed cold. Your mom and dad took care of you whenever you couldn't take care of yourself. You owe it to your mom and dad to take care of them when they can't take care of themselves. And you're a sorry son or daughter if you won't do it. Don't forget Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We studied together. We worked together. We labored together. We reached our convictions together. Don't forget them, and they didn't. Daniel chapter 5, we find his courage. Chapter 5, verse 22. Obviously, I'm just skipping to give highlights. Daniel chapter 5, verse 22. And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, Daniel speaking to the king, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this, but thou hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, They have brought the vessels of the house before thee, and thou and thy lords, thy wives, and thy concubines have drunk wine in them. Thou hast praised the gods of silver and gold, of brass, iron, wood, and stone, which see not, hear not, know not, and the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified. Well, you talk about a courageous prophet standing in front of the king. You have worshiped the gods of silver and gold and brass and iron. I think America probably could be put in that category to a large degree. We honor and praise the God of gold and silver and wealth. He said, you've ignored the laws of God. Then was part of the hand sent from him, and his writing was written. And this is the writing that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting. Peres, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Oh, I marvel. Pagan king. Daniel says, you've not honored the laws of God. You've worshiped the God of gold and silver. You've lived wickedly before God. And here's the vision. You're weighing the balances and found wanting, and God is going to divide the kingdom from you. You're going to die in God's judgment, and your kingdom is going to be given to the Medes and the Persians. And the king says, fellas, bring a robe and put on him. Isn't Daniel a wonderful man? Remember the king of Israel, Ahab? Wanting to go to war with Syria? Well, Ahab's not the only guy that wants to go to war with Syria. I know some guys today that want to go to war with Syria. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of Christians in Syria. The Assad government in Syria grants religious liberty to the Christians in Syria. The United States is supporting the Sunni ISIS Muslim rebels fighting the Assad government in Syria. If the Sunni Muslims dethrone Syria, they will implement despotic Muslim law in Syria, and those tens of thousands of Christians in Syria will, many of them, be killed, tortured, maimed, beheaded, imprisoned. Whose side are we really on here? In 2012, Vladimir Putin made a promise to the people of Russia that he would protect Christianity and Christians from persecution in the Middle East and anywhere that he could, and he was speaking specifically of Syria. He promised to protect the Christians of Syria. The United States is fighting a proxy war against the Syrian government of Assad, trying to kill Assad and destroy his government. And here, just a few days ago, Vladimir Putin has sent special forces, Russian troops, and aircraft, fighter aircraft, into Syria to help protect the Syrian people. And our government sits back and says, gee, I wonder what Putin is up to. I don't know the heart of Vladimir Putin. Only God knows that. Yes, I know Putin was a former head of the KGB. So what? George H.W. Bush was the former head of the CIA. And if there's a moral difference between the CIA and the KGB, I sure don't know what it is. Maybe, I don't know what all the reasons are. Yeah, I know there's ports there that he needs. I know there's other geopolitical reasons why he would want to defend Syria. But maybe, just maybe, Putin is honoring his word that he gave back in 2012, and he might be saying, I'm not going to let these Sunni Muslims, sponsored by the United States and Great Britain and Tel Aviv and Saudi Arabia, destroy the Christians of Syria. I'm going to go protect them, as I said I would. I don't know all of that, but I do know this. Ahab, the king of Israel, had a prophet, Milkiah, stand in front of him and say, if you go to war with the Syrians, you're going to die, your sons are going to die, and your army is going to be destroyed. And what did Ahab do to Micaiah? Threw him back in prison and probably beat him within an inch of his life in doing so. Here, a pagan king, Belshazzar, hears the prophet say, you've disobeyed the laws of God, and God is going to rend your kingdom and give it to the Medes and Persians, and you're going to die in the judgment of God. And the heathen king says, put a scarlet robe on him. Isn't he a great man? Blows your mind, doesn't it? This letter I read from this atheist, she has a better understanding and a better appreciation of the principles of freedom and even the Christian basis for freedom in America than many pastors in the pulpits of America today. It blows my mind. The courage of this prophet. In chapter 6, his defiance of unjust law. You know the story, I won't read it. The Babylonian princes were jealous of Daniel's success. And don't think it a strange thing whenever you become successful at whatever you do that people will be jealous of you, because it will happen. That's just the nature of human nature, especially people that don't have much character. Rather than letting your example encourage them, motivate them, and inspire them to do better themselves and to achieve more themselves, they would rather just get jealous and hate you because you did and they didn't. And that's what happened here. These Babylonian princes were jealous of Daniel's success. They plotted together, they conspired together a plan on how they could defeat Daniel. They reasoned among themselves that the only thing they could do to get to Daniel was they had to find something that would violate his conscience before God. So they went to Nebuchadnezzar and they schmoozed him real good. And said, you know, Nebuchadnezzar, you're the greatest king in the history of the world. There's never been a king like you. You're such a magnificent ruler and a wonderful, you know, you need to make a law that no one can pray to any other god but you for, what was it, 40 days? 30 days? This is in the text. I am pretty special, aren't I? Thanks, guys. So decreed. And Nebuchadnezzar wasn't thinking. He was just letting all of the false approbation get to his pride. No one can pray to anybody else's God except Nebuchadnezzar for whatever the period was. Daniel read the law. Whoops. Got a problem here. Now I can hear all the pragmatic Christians around America when I read this story. You know, it really irks me that they even teach this story anymore in the churches. This one in Daniel 3 with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego bowing, not bowing down to Nebuchadnezzar in the fiery furnace. Forgive me, but I think most of the Sunday schools and most of the churches in America should rip those chapters out of their Bibles. They mean nothing to you. Nothing to you. Obey the government no matter what. Tell it to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Rip Daniel 3 out of your Bible. Daniel 6, can't pray. And all the Christians say, oh, come on, Brother Baldwin. No one can force a person to not pray. We can pray in our hearts. Oh, shut up. My favorite Jay Leno quote. Daniel went home, opened the doors of his house, the windows of his house toward Jerusalem, and prayed audibly, just as he had always done. He changed nothing. The law meant nothing to Daniel. Why? There is a law higher than the law. There is a king higher than the king. And Daniel prayed with his voice. Guess who was standing underneath the window listening with a tape recorder? Those jealous princes ran back to King Nebuchadnezzar. Oh, we hate to tell you this. Oh, it breaks our heart to have to tell you this. You know that law you passed, that law you signed? No longer break. Yeah. Daniel prayed to his God. He broke your law. Then the king knew he had been had. He knew he had been duped. Too late. The law was irreversible. We go back, you read the story, and as they get ready to throw Daniel in the den of lions, hungry, ravenous beasts who hadn't eaten for days, the king said to Daniel, Daniel, oh, I'm sorry. I was stupid. I was tricked. can't reverse it. But you know what, Daniel? I believe your God is going to protect you in that den of lions. That's what the king said. I believe your God's going to protect you. Again, doesn't it amaze you how pagans sometimes have greater understanding of truth than those that call themselves God's people? Well, threw him in. Overnight, next morning early, the king runs to the opening of the den. Oh, Daniel! Let's see if we can find it. Verse 20. And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel, and the king spake and said, Daniel, oh Daniel, why would he even go? Why would he even go holler into the den if he didn't think that God may spare him? Daniel, oh Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God whom thou servest continually able to deliver thee from the lions? Then said Daniel unto the king, O king, live forever. My God hath sent his angel and has shut the lions' mouths. They have not hurt me, for as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt. Then was the king exceeding glad for him, and commanded they should take Daniel up out of the den. Daniel was taken up out of the den. No hurt was upon him. And the king commanded, they brought those men which had cursed Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, and their children and their wives and the lions had mastery of them, and break all their bones in pieces, or ever they came at the bottom of the den, before even they hit bottom. Then King Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages, and to all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever, and his kingdom which shall not be destroyed, his dominion shall be unto the end. He delivereth and rescueth, he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and earth. He hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lion. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. His defiance of unjust law. Again, like with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the real story is not that God delivered Daniel. The real story is that Daniel was willing to go in to the den of lions. That's the story. And thank God he did. And then, of course, lastly, his favor with God. And I'll just touch on this. Go to chapter 9. And in verses 1 through 23, we have the vision that God gave him relative to the 70 weeks. Let's begin reading in verse 20. And while I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of my God. Now, Jimmy, just pause here. Daniel was a student of the scriptures already written. He was a student of the writing of Jeremiah, the prophet. Jeremiah had prophesied a 70-year captivity of the Israelites, of the Hebrews. Daniel was reading it, and he recognized that they were coming to the end of that 70-year period. And that's what is prompting this prayer of Daniel. His reading of the book of Jeremiah, the 70-year captivity, and the end of it now upon them. So Daniel is praying. And while I was speaking and praying, that's what this is about, I was presenting my supplication to the Lord. While I was speaking, verse 21, in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, go back to chapter 2, being caused to fly swiftly and touch me about the time of the evening oblation. And he informed me and talked to me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give thee skill and understanding. At the beginning of thy supplications, the commandment came forth, and I am come to show thee, for thou art greatly beloved. Just pause there. How would you like to have the Archangel Gabriel appear to you and say, thou art greatly beloved? This is a special man. God sent his angel to tell him, thou art greatly beloved. Therefore, understand the matter and consider the vision. In the remaining verses of the chapter, verses 24 through 27, is the vision of what is called the 70 weeks. And it's not the purpose of this address to go into the details of what I believe this prophecy states. However, let me just say, there is no controversy among Bible teachers and students alike relative to the 69 weeks being, or 483 years, and I've gone back to all my commentators from the old generations, and they all are in unison on this. There's not a controversy that he's talking about a 483 period of time, year period of time, leading up to the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ, the Messiah, and his death on the cross. There's no controversy about that among any of the teachers and scholars that I've read. The only controversy pertains to the last verse, he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, meaning a 7-year period. So the total period is 490 years, 69, and then the last 7 years, making 70 weeks, 70 times 7 years, 490 years, is the prophecy. Jesus came at exactly the time that Daniel predicted that he would come. At the 483-year mark, Jesus was cut off, as it said the Messiah would be. He was crucified. And then the 1 week, making the 70 weeks, would come. That's where the controversy comes in. And that's where your dispensationalists see a 2,000-plus year gap in between the 69th and 70th week. They say the 70th week is still future. That's what they refer to as the tribulation, the 7-year tribulation. He talks about the first 3.5 years and the second 3.5 years in verse 27. And that's where your dispensationalists will say the first 3.5 years are the calm before the storm and the tribulation is not great, and then the second 3.5 years the great tribulation takes place, and then the coming of the Lord is after that, and they read all of that into this passage. In all candor and all honesty, as I have restudied over these last several years so much of what I was taught, including prophecy, I no longer believe that interpretation. I believe that as you're reading this passage naturally, it's kind of like Genesis 1 and Genesis 1:2. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And then in verse 2, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And I know a lot of Bible teachers that believe that in between verse 1 and verse 2 of Genesis 1 is a huge millions of years time frame. They call it the gap theory. And they conveniently put all of the evolutionary theories in between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. And they say, yeah, God created everything in verse 1, and then there was this big gap of millions and millions and millions and millions of years, and evolution, all the evolution stuff is put in there, and then God picks it up again, you know, and carries on with the story of creation. I remember when I was a freshman in college, I got invited to preach up with some other preacher boys. They were all upperclassmen. I was the only underclassman. In the upper peninsula of Michigan. And there were several churches that had come together for a youth rally. And they had the youth rally on Saturday night. And then we, the preacher boys from the college, were going to be divvied up among the churches on Sunday, and we would preach. But before that, after, as a part of the youth rally, the preacher boys, I think it was four or five of us, we had to get up on the stage and answer questions from the pastors in the audience. You know, kind of like an inquisition. Not really. But the question I got, I'm a freshman! I haven't even finished one semester of college yet. Jack, do you believe in the gap theory? I said, what's the gap theory? And everybody goes, he says, you know, the theory that says there's millions of years in between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. Do you believe in the gap theory? I said, no, I don't believe that at all. Well, they all did. So guess who didn't get picked to go preach at anybody's church the next day? Everybody else, you know, I felt like the NFL draft, you know, it's like, oh yeah, we want you, you know, you're kindergarten in the playground. Oh, we want you, and then here you are, you're left, you know. Nobody picked you. Sad, I'm telling you. It was a crushing blow to my male masculinity and my ego and my confidence and everything. It was dashed. Nobody picked me. So finally, after everybody had pretty much gone, and I'm just kind of standing around, this pastor, host church, it was his church they were meeting in, he comes up to me, you know, with that, oh, I'm so sorry look on his face, you know. He said, Chuck, I'm sorry. Tell you what, if you don't mind staying here, I'm going to preach in my church tomorrow morning, but I'll let you preach for me tomorrow night, if that's okay. I said, great, fantastic. I get to preach tomorrow night. Everybody else was preaching on Sunday morning. I get to preach tomorrow night. I preached on Sunday night, and guess what? We had four people accept Jesus Christ as our personal Savior. Four. Nobody else had anybody saved in any of the other services that weekend. So what man meant for harm, God meant for good. So then I had to study the gap theory, find out what this thing was that almost ended my career before it ever started. No, I don't buy that either. I didn't buy it then, I don't buy it now. There are no millions of years in between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. It is what it is. It reads as it reads. You got to get to Bible college and be taught all that stuff to learn it. You don't learn it from reading the Bible. And you don't learn a big 2,000-year gap of time between the 69th and the 70th week. They run concurrently. Just since I went this far, I'll just, without going into deep details, Jesus was cut off at the 69th week. You got 70 years left. There's a half and half, 3.5-year period, a 3.5-year period. Something major going on. What was the major going on? He's going to confirm the covenant with many after the 69th week. He confirmed it with the church and the church at Jerusalem. And the gift of languages was given at the day of Pentecost. And the church began. It was confirmed with many for 1 week, for 3.5 years. The first half, in the midst of the week, that would be the 3.5-year mark, approximately, he'll cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. Well, what happened at the 3.5-year mark after the death and resurrection of Christ? The persecution of the church at Jerusalem was so intense, the Jews had to leave, the Christian believers had to leave and flee Jerusalem, and they left Jerusalem, and they left the synagogue in Jerusalem. They left the sacrifices that were going on there during that time. They had to flee Jerusalem during that time. What happened 3.5 years later? Making the full 70 weeks. 3.5 years later, AD, now we're at AD 40. AD 33 and AD 34, the Jews persecuted the church so much in Jerusalem, they had to flee for their lives. 3.5 years later, now we're at AD 40. What happened then? Peter got the vision to go to the house of Cornelius, a Gentile, and preach the gospel. And the gospel now was taken to the Gentiles. And the church became mostly a Gentilic church. And God turned from the Hebrews to the Gentiles. And the 70 weeks was complete. And the prophecy, meaning the desolation of abomination, the consummation and all that, that happened when Titus invaded Jerusalem in 70 AD and totally destroyed the city and destroyed the temple, destroyed the sacrifices, destroyed everything in Jerusalem. That was the fulfillment, the ultimate fulfillment, which began at the persecution. By the way, Jesus in Matthew 24, he referred to Daniel, and he talked about the abomination of desolation. What was he talking about in Matthew 24? He was talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. The destruction of Jerusalem. So Daniel gave the prophecy regarding the coming of Messiah, the crucifixion of Messiah, the resurrection of Messiah, the institution of the church beginning, the persecution of the church, and the message taken to the Gentiles. All of that from the 70 week, and that's a very brief review. And then in verses 10, 11, and 12, we have the prophecy of Antiochus Epiphanes. Again, this is where I'm going to diverge from those who are of dispensational thinking and who believe that these passages are dealing with prophetic events relative to the coming of Christ. No, they are talking about the coming of Antiochus Epiphanes in Daniel chapter 11 and Daniel chapter 12. He prophesied all of the stated language of this passage equates perfectly with the coming of Antiochus Epiphanes and the destruction of Jerusalem during that period. And in the Maccabean revolt, which drove the invaders out of Jerusalem. This was Antiochus Epiphanes. This is the same language and the same description that you're going to read in Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39. the Gog and Magog invasion. In my opinion, that has nothing to do with Russia, has nothing to do with future events. It has everything to do with Antiochus Epiphanes. Ezekiel is describing the invasion of Jerusalem by Antiochus in the same way that Daniel is envisioning the invasion of Jerusalem by Antiochus Epiphanes. Look at chapter 10, verses 10 through 14. And behold, an hand touched me, which set me upon my knees and upon the palms of my hands, and said unto me, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved. There it is again. The angel, a man greatly beloved. Understand the words that I speak unto thee, and stand upright, for unto thee now am I now sent. And when he had spoken this word unto me, I stood trembling. Then said he unto me, Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day thou didst set thine heart to understand and to chasten thyself before thy God, thy words were heard, and I'm come for thy words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 120 days. Now, the kingdom of Persia withstanding the angel only makes sense if you recognize the demonic angels that were protecting and inspiring and guarding the king of Persia. So obviously this is a demonic force that is prohibiting Gabriel from delivering his message for 21 days. But Michael, the archangel, the one more powerful than Gabriel, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia. I think I've mentioned before, if we could only know how many battles are going on in the spirit world surrounding us, It would amaze us. The spiritual battles that are going on in this place as I speak every Sunday. The spiritual battles that are affecting you, and when you try to do the will of God and you try to obey God, and the ambassadors of hell are set against you to thwart what you're doing. The spiritual warfare that takes place on a daily basis. Gabriel is telling him this. I would have been here 21 days ago, but this force in Persia prevented me. There was war to be done here, spiritual war. Michael, the archangel, had to come and assist me. And yet, still longer, we stayed there, and we took care of what needed to be done. Now I am come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days. For yet the vision is for many days. And he tells him then the vision through chapter 11 and through chapter 12, the envision of the coming of Antiochus Epiphanes against Jerusalem. Daniel was the lion of prophecy. A man greatly beloved. Not only for the visions and the prophecies that God gave him, but the heart, the character, the integrity, the honor that this man had, even from the time he was about 12 years of age. Daniel is one of the few heroes of the Bible that we have recorded for us in Scripture in which there is not one negative thing mentioned. Not one. Not even some of the great men that we're going to study later are going to be able to say that. Daniel, the lion of prophecy. Let's stand for prayer.